Morning.
And ladies and gentlemen, my name is Lena Kitt, and I am a 2003 graduate of the National Labor College. I'm also a member of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters and the American Federation of Teachers. We were asked here by our mentor, Ruth Rutenberg, to represent the National Labor College. Along with me today is Eduardo Rosario. He's a member of the National Writers Union, graduated from the National Labor College in 2009, and Lita Rambo, also a 2009 graduate, Sheet Metal Workers Association. I'd like to give you a little background on the National Labor College. The college was established as a training center for the AFL-CIO in 1969 to strengthen union education and training skills. The National Labor College became a degree-granting college in 1997. Middle States Commission on Higher Education accredits the college, an independent regional accrediting body recognized by the U.S. Department of Education. For graduation, each student must write a thesis on a subject that they feel will either help their own union or the labor movement in general. For myself, I wrote on a subject that has become not only my cause, but a subject that is very close and dear to my heart. On September 11, 2001, I worked in one of the adjacent buildings to the North Tower of the World Trade Center. It was the beginning of a work day, and we were discussing what we discussed at the New York City Housing Authority before the day begins, and all of a sudden we heard a very loud noise. Noise like I've never heard in my life. We ran to the windows such as those, and when we got there, we saw like streams of paper coming out. And as we looked, we saw, the first thing I saw was something moving like this. And I thought it was a bird, but it was a man's thigh. And one by one, I watched people jumping to their death. This is a sight that will be ingrained in my mind forever. After that, we were relocated to many, many different offices. We didn't have one particular place to go anymore. We had, for the Housing Authority, different locations in the five boroughs, so we were all split up. We didn't know who made it out of the building. The building was closed down when the first plane hit, and we were told to stay. Finally, after the second plane hit, we were told to evacuate, which we did. When I came down, I saw the shoes of all the people that had jumped right in front of my door. So, of course, this has been a very traumatic experience for me. I went to the National Labor College in 2002 of April, and I didn't know what I was going to write on. And all of a sudden I said, you know, the building I left is probably highly contaminated. We saw people jumping to their death. People are probably suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So I decided to do my paper on, is there a need for a post-traumatic stress disorder program after 9/11 for the employees of the New York City Housing Authority who work in the buildings adjacent to the World Trade Center? So what I did was I surveyed the employees. I handed out surveys, and they sent them back anonymously to me. And I received 75 back from employees, which was a pretty good number of surveys to come back. When the surveys were completed, the responses fell into certain seven categories: total symptoms, physical symptoms, depressive symptoms, avoidance symptoms, angry explosive symptoms, intrusive thoughts, and work-specific symptoms. The most striking findings in the study that, one, the response rate was extremely high. Women were more symptomatic than men. People living with families were more symptomatic than those living alone. Location at the time of the attack made little difference in reported symptoms. There were no difference by job title and few by ethnicity. Almost 80% of the respondents wanted some sort of talking help. Few wanted medication. Now we're talking back in 2002. 2001. The New York City Housing Authority employees work close to Ground Zero. They continue to suffer significant symptoms of post-traumatic stress, anxiety, depression, 9 months after the World Trade Center attacks, and more symptoms are starting to come today as we speak. Back then, I became very involved. So I did this paper and I said, well, yeah, that's great. I did the survey. What do I do now? I just can't leave it at this. I've got to get some help here. So about a year after that, I became involved with a coalition called the 19th Church Street Labor Coalition, which is the building that I worked in. And just to give you the proximity of where I was, this is where I worked, and this is the North Tower. So I was right in it. And number 7 was right behind us. When we left, 7 actually collapsed into 90 Church Street, and it really did a number on that building. There were 700 windows were blown out, we had fires, we had mold, we had the sprinkler system running for a minimum of 5 days. The building was shut down until we went back in 2004, which is how bad the place was contaminated. So what we did was form a coalition of city, state, and federal employees who went back to 90 Church Street to see if we could get, this was a 1930s historical landmark building. So the windows were old, they were rickety, and all the stuff was coming in. Even though the place was gutted and cleaned and filtered, we still had stuff coming in. So we formed the coalition, and we fought for 3 years. And at that time, they thought we were crazy. As it proves today, we were right. And we did, and I'm proud to say, get interior windows in all of 90 Church Street, which was an amazing win. And we won from NICOS, New York Committee on Occupational Safety and Health. The coalition won a union award for unions working together, not crossing lines, and winning something that was absolutely amazing. So that was great for the breathing problems. I myself now suffer from asthma because of this. I have never left the area because when I was told to go back, I do hearings for the Housing Authority, I went back 2 blocks from the site. So I have been breathing this stuff in for the last 8-9 years. I also live in the downtown area, so I have never escaped this. I see the hole every day. I feel the heaviness on my chest. So what was the next step to do? We needed a program, which I'm proud to say, it's called the World Trade Center Survivors Bill, which just passed the full House of Representatives, which was an amazing win through the help of Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney and Jerry Nadler. Without them, this bill would not now be going for full vote after committee and onto the Senate. It's the Zagota bill, which was the detective that died from the effects of World Trade Center. And the bill is named after him. And now the survivor bill includes not just rescue and recovery, because they were always getting help from day one. We, as office workers, lived that stuff. Every single day, we had nowhere to go. So a program started in Bellevue Hospital, which expanded to Elmhurst Hospital in Queens, and then to Gouverneur Hospital in downtown Manhattan. The funding was almost stopped until this bill just passed the full committee. And people now can go and get medication for free, workups on their health that is just absolutely amazing. And I became the poster child, I have to say, here I am, in this little brochure. And if anybody needs or knows anybody that works downtown, I have little magnets from HHC. Our work is not done. I mean, we're still fighting to get this passed, and it's a struggle. It's really a struggle. Anytime you work with, I hate to say, Republicans, they're trying to say that this benefit is an entitlement for New York. This not an entitlement. This is necessary. Every day, more and more people are coming down with symptoms from 9/11. And the symptoms are terrible. There's headaches, GERD, post-traumatic stress. I mean, you name it, people now starting to feel the effects. And it's 8 years down the pipe. I think beforehand, people were a little embarrassed to say what was going on, but now, because it has become an issue where everybody knows what's going on in that area, we have a place where people go. So it's imperative when you go back home to speak to your congresspeople and your senators and tell them that we want this bill to pass, because 21 states are now feeling the effects of 9/11, because either the people from New York ran, or people that came in for rescue recovery went back to their home state and now are getting sick. And they are now part of this program. Also in our program, we also cover children, which is the only program that covers children, because there were several schools in the area as well. So my paper put a bug in me to do something about windows. I never thought it would lead to me doing something about health and continued health for the people that work or live down around the 9/11 area. So thank you for listening to my story, and I thank Ruth Rutenberg for all the pushing that she did for me, and she knows what I've been through. I mean, I did not get a promotion at my job because I was so involved with 9/11, because I thought I was crazy. You know, being a union rep and going against management, they don't like you. So I'm still in my same position 24 years later, but I know in my heart I'm leaving something for the people that come after me. This is my legacy. They're breathing clean air in that building, and they're going to be able to get help. So thank you.
Thank you. So when I look at the, I guess, the demographics of the industry from when I first came in 22 years ago to now, it's obvious that it's changing within the building trades. And I'm looking at the industry and our workers and the members and thinking, how are we responding to this change? So my senior paper, I picked it on embracing diversity in the building trade unions, which is the key thing to the survival of the unions. When we look at the demographics of the unions and what it was years ago as opposed to what it is now, you probably would have found a white male somewhere between the age of 18 to maybe 22 who lived at home, and whose father or uncle or someone in the family that was probably within the building trade unions. And the culture of the building trade unions was pretty much around that demographic group. And when you look at the entrance now, well, you may find people anywhere from 28 to 35, they may be African American, Latino, Latino, Asian, speaking various languages, and oftentimes are the head of their own households. And so what's happening is that there's a cultural change in the industry. And unfortunately, if the building trades are not able to adjust to this cultural change, it really is divided, and therefore making a weaker union and making us more susceptible to non-union workers doing the work that we traditionally had. Over the next 10 years, they're estimating that they need about 185,000 new entrants into the building trade unions to be able to just keep up the workforce. Manpower, if you want to call it that, for what we need. And most of the unions now are having retirement and pension plans where you can get got after 30 years of working and 55 years old. Some of them have a combination of 80, how it works out, or 70, you know, 20 years and 50 years old, or how it works out. So a great deal of our skill is now leaving the trade, and so we're left behind with these new entrants. They're not really skilled, and we're going to lose a lot of the skill that we have. So it poses a problem for us. What do we do? Well, in my union, for about 11 years, I taught in the apprenticeship school, and I, you know, worked on, you know, diversity and accepting and dealing with people that are different cultures from you, really on a broad sense. My paper, I really focused it on women, because I guess that was the area that was dearest, you know, dearest to my heart. You know, my perspective is as a black woman in a male-dominated white trade. And what I tried to do on my paper was to really broaden my perspective and to kind of look at it from all, you know, from all angles, not just from the new entrance angle, but for the people that are already there and now having to deal with their culture, which they've been very proud of. And that culture is really what built the city and built the strong unions. And I'm trying to find a way, how do we integrate the two? And how do the unions accept diversity and stay strong and maybe not so much hold on to the old culture, be able to kind of integrate so they can change the culture. And that's really what I focus my paper on. When you look at the building trade union, they are becoming more and more diverse. I did a literature review. That was one of the main things in my paper. And one of the first books I did was on issues on gender and diversity management. The author was Ralph Okun. And one of the things that he preached more than anything else in that book was the need for diversity training and the benefits of it. Now, traditionally in the building trade unions, you know, this is, you know, more of a macho type of environment, and that idea of, you know, diversity training, you know, is not always met with open arms. But in his book, it shows some of the benefits of it. In general, it encourages fair and equitable treatment for all people, no matter, you know, no matter who they are. And one of the things I noticed is that, at least with my union, it's difficult to keep that training up. We had a program, a curriculum that I was asked to develop, and I did some training at Cordell to be able to develop the program. And as long as I was there and I was teaching it, the program went on. When I stopped teaching and worked back in, you know, my field as a technician in my field, the program just kind of slowly came to a halt. So one of the things that we learned that obviously whatever program you set up, it really has to stop from the top and work its way down. That is the ideal way. At the apprenticeship school that I worked at, let's just get it somewhere. So we taught it to the apprentices, which was a start. It gave them the idea of, you know, what was proper and improper behavior. It gave them more awareness and a kind of solidarity among the apprentices. But the bottom line, they still had to go back out to the fields with their mechanics, with the shop stewards and with the owners and everyone else. And they're like the little guy in the totem pole. So now they're trying to, you know, present it to them, which it's not really the most effective way. It was something, but really not the way that you want to do it to make it the most successful. And one of the things that we learned that with women, it's really no different from any other group. I mean, traditionally, our cultures and Americans, we call this, our country, the great melting pot. And basically what the melting pot means that everyone comes in and you lose your characteristics and you kind of blend together. That's really what happens in a melting pot. But when you think about respect and diversity, it's a little bit different. Because what happens is that everyone comes in with their individual culture and their traits, and, you know, and we don't really blend them all together, but we accept them and we're able to maybe take things from each other's cultures without really having to change a person. And that's quite a bit of a different ideology for the building trade union. Construction workers. So that's one of the challenges, is to be able to take people from different different places and let them keep their identity as opposed to losing their identity. When you don't have proper diversity and training, then what you end up with stereotyping, prejudice, discrimination, and organizations find themselves being a lot of lawsuits that are unnecessary. My union is one that's had a lawsuit with them for about 30 years. Unfortunately, we're infamous for our lawsuit. We're just in the last 2 or 3 years in the process of coming out of it. It had nothing to do with discrimination against women because they didn't even really kind of get on the radar. But it had to do with nepotism and discrimination against people with Latino surnames and African Americans. So that's who the lawsuit is about. And it's been quite expensive for us to handle that. And so that's one of the reasons why we're looking to see what can we do in terms of diversity. One of the things that this author also brought up was that in the past, you know, we say, you know, your parents say, what's the golden rule? Do unto others as you would have others do unto you. That's the golden rule. We're taught, okay, that's correct. But now we're looking at diversity training and respecting people's individuality. It changes a little bit. And the new golden rule is do unto others as they would do unto themselves. So the difference that we have to really kind of keep in mind in part of the diversity training is that what's acceptable necessarily for me, the way I prefer to be treated, might not be the same way that you want to be treated. And I have to be open to treat you according to what you consider to be respectful and proper, which might be very different from mine. So that is one of the things that that needs to be changed in terms of thinking regarding diversity. In general, there's been an influx of women into all aspects of the United States culture and the workforce. In the building trades, it's been much shorter. The federal government has a percentage of 6% they would like to see on federal and state jobs. And currently, we're about probably at maybe 3%. In my present level, we're less than 1%. So it's not so much just having federal regulations, but now it's being able to enforce some of those regulations. There was one book that I found probably the most enlightening, and this book was called White Men, Women, and Minorities in the Changing Workforce by Anthony Pissarro. And this book was written from a white man's perspective, a white man in power perspective, which is an outlook that I tend not to look at, you know. And the importance of this book, I thought, is because as minorities and as different acts like the Civil Rights Act and affirmative action, and all the things that come on to try to put minorities into the workplace, it really has overlooked the people that were already in the workplace a lot of times. And the frustration that those who were in the power and now seeing it pretty much being taken over by another group is something that we tend to ignore. And I think that was a very important aspect in this book. If I feel like I'm being discriminated against, there are several resources I can go to. You know, or I'm a woman, okay, I'm black, or I mean, there's a number of places and organizations that could be right behind me, you know, waving a flag, so to speak, you know. But what does a white man do if he feels he's discriminated against? I mean, do people really even take it seriously? Or is the general outlook, hopefully, he's got to get everyone to see who's in charge? So it helped me to see really the frustration that would be, especially if you're already here and you've had nothing to do with the discrimination that came, you know, behind you, maybe your fathers or your forefathers. You've just been given this position. You didn't step on anybody's toes. You didn't try to, you know, knock out this candidate or that candidate. And I found this book very enlightening. There was one portion of this this book that I quoted directly that I just want to read to you. Since over the past several years, white males have seen government and corporations pressure to pass laws and promote the cause of women and racial minority groups. Businesses send out special recruiters who offer jobs to women and racial minorities. The white male perceives these minorities as moving up the management ladder faster than he because of minority quotas and affirmative action. Observing this cultural shift, the majority of white men in America feels confused, isolated, lonely, and alienated in ways they cannot voice. When you do voice their concerns and bring it up reverse discrimination issues, they are seen as racist, oppressive, or even clueless. And I can imagine the frustration of that, really not having an outlet to even be able to say what you're thinking. Another thing that he brought up is that when minorities are coming into a new workforce that's been traditionally one demographic, it's important for minorities to really recognize and to respect the, let's say, the greatness of that industry. It had to happen because of the people that were already there. And so it's important to give people their credit and realize if you wanted to continue with this greatness, with the new group, has to respect diversity just as much by realizing that there is valuable information, input in the group that you're coming into. He put it this way. It is important for men, particularly white men, to better understand themselves if they are to profit from a changing culture. And it is important for women and minorities to have a good understanding of American white men if they are going to be equal partners with them, join them in an effective alliance for change, and benefit fully from white males' contribution to their failures. Dismissing or attacking the white male is naive. White males hold a dominant power in our society as essential contributors to the successes we have experienced in the workplace and in this country. White males now cannot be excluded. To profit more from a democratic and diverse culture, any societal change must include and enrich everyone, not just a select few. A more balanced view of white males, their contributions, their failures, and their future in America in the 21st century is necessary. And I thought that was really key. The building trade unions didn't get to where they are without white men. Yeah. Those trades, those skilled laborers that came to the country and built this country. And they certainly can't stay united and stay strong without those same individuals. And I thought this was very important. And it was really very enlightening for me to look at it from another perspective. Another book that I used was Women in Unions, Forging a Partnership. The editor was Dorothy Sue Cobble. And in this union, this book talked about the historical relationship between women and unions. So in my union, the women who are in this, it's a small percentage, but the vast majority are women that are minorities, either black women or Latino women. But when I look at some of the other building trade unions, like electricians, it's not necessarily the case. So whereas sometimes the women might be dealing with a double minority, oftentimes it's just the fact that you're a woman. And traditionally, there have been some strife between unions and women and management, and that management is oftentimes used women as a pawn, to get the one to inspire the men to work harder, long hours, and poor working conditions. Or the women have now been put in a situation where they had a household, they've been forced to work, and they need it, so now to work at a lower wage to do the same work. So it's important also for union members to realize that oftentimes some of the strife might be also for management, management, and just another form to keep us kind of at each other so that they can pay the least for the most amount of work, which traditionally, that's how management works oftentimes when a union is not involved. And she mentioned that organized labor can benefit from the presence of a woman, just from having one a different perspective that comes on. And she mentioned that the days of automatic preference for a white male really needs to kind of, it has to change, because we're in the situation where we have this influx of new workers. And so the workers are here, and now it's a matter of, are we going to utilize that workforce in a way that's going to keep us solidified and organized as a union? She identified the traditional relationship between women and unions as a love-hate type of relationship. And oftentimes the unions fear that women, you know, we're going to be competing for these jobs that men had, and that was really the problem of it. An additional problem when you're working with the building trades union is that it is considered to be man's work. And I know that when I first came into the trade 22 years ago, and it's hard for me to say 22 years ago because I can't believe I've gotten that old over the years, but I have. The trades are a lot more physical than they are now. And sometimes it's recognizing that the trade has changed itself. She metal workers was considered to be one of the most physical trades. I will go back even before I came in. There were no automatic drills. There were no what we called duck lifts, which actually lift up the duck work. The men were the duck lifts. The metal was very heavy gauge steel. Instead of using drills, they used they called a pin and a parker, where you literally have a pin and a hammer and you bang it to start a hole, and then you screw it in. So, I mean, you can see that everybody had the Popeye forearms. And then there were still women that could do it. I don't know if someone in my frame might have been able to do it then, but there were some women, but that was very much the minority. And so it's considered man's work. Now, as all the trades have now kind of evolved into a more technological trade, well, goodness, there's no pen and parking, it's a drill gun. Drill gun being less than 10 pounds, maybe 5 pounds, well, that's no big deal. We have what we call self-tapping screws. They do the work. It's no pin and parker, you know, you need the big. And we have what we call a duck lift. So there's someone just doing this and the duck goes up as opposed to. So some of the traditional culture that, you know, that men tough it out construction worker stereotypes are really just that. And sometimes with the diversity training, what I found is necessary to do is to really point out what are the stereotypes of our building trades. And sometimes just to list them out. You know, okay, the sexist, catcalls, you make a lot of money, they just run out, you know, with a bunch of stereotypes. And then, okay, now once you guys can look at this paper, and we have some, you know, references too, once you look at this board, we don't want to know which ones fit you, but how many of these stereotypes fit you? And there might be 15 or 20 on the board, and by the time I get around to each student, just give me a number, you may say 5, you may say 2, 4, I will have one guy who says 12, or 13, okay, that guy is our traditional, stereotypical construction worker, but that's the minority. So sometimes it helps to see that we're all kind of, you know, making this culture, it's imagination, imaginary culture that used to be there, and we're all trying to live under it, and we think about it, none of us are really like that, or a very, very small population. So sometimes that's important also to be able to, you know, to break down some of the stereotypes and realize that even though all of us are construction workers, very few of us fit into those stereotypes. There was one book that was written, it's a series of stories written by some of the women that were the first ones to come into the building trade unions. And it was called Call You If You Need You, Experiences from Women Working Construction by Susan Eisenberg. I read this book many years ago when I first got into the trade, you know, read it and was mad for like a month, you know. Read it again later, a little older, more mature, not quite as mad, but still get mad when I read it, but, you know, sometimes it's important to really look to see what progress have we made. Talk about just some of the everyday things that women have dealt with over the years in the construction industry that we, you know, it's kind of unheard of in a lot of other places. You know, maybe years ago, the harassment that exists, let's say, on another job, not construction, might be, you know, someone trying to chase you, either chasing the secretary around the desk. That was the type of harassment that you got. In the construction industry, the harassment tends to be much more bolder, more aggressive, and more hostile in the industry. And I have seen it change significantly over the years, but there's still quite a bit that has to change. And some of the experiences that the women had put there were with pornography. Now, many of the general contractors are making sure that pornography is not on the jobs. Some of the problems is that they oftentimes they wait until a woman is coming to the job or on the job to say, take it down. And the problem with that is that now you're perceived as, you know, come on, you know, we messing up our fun here. Make us take our pictures down. So the training has to also go as far as the management agencies to know, to look at it really more so as a safety issue. And I know when I'm a shop steward on the job, that's how I present it. You want an environment that people can work in a safe environment and one that's without distractions. Some women are bolder. I have one friend of mine, she went on a job site and the shanty with plenty of naked women in all various positions, and she asked the guy to take it down and like, hey, you want to be in here? This is men's work, this is men's shanty. I said, okay. Next day, she came in very early with quite a bit of pictures of her own. That she picked up from the village in New York City of all male, also in various positions, and she had them up for the guys, and they came in, and almost immediately they took down their pictures. I mean, it was like a miracle. She left hers up for the whole day, you know, but she took hers down to the next day. I mean, some of us can be that bold. That was never really wasn't my style to do that, but it was effective. And this is some of the things that women have to, you know, various strategies to try to make it in this industry. So, from this particular book, you know, my perspective from the author was that you need someone really up top, whether it's the general contractor, to really set the tone beforehand. And the bottom line is that we all need mentors. So the women that really stayed here, they were able to retain, were ones that worked with decent men and who had mentors that, you know, were a kind of protector for them so that they can get the training that they needed to get. And I even had a testimony for myself. There was in New York City, are there enough non-traditional employment opportunities for women in New York City? And I testified at this particular hearing. And one of the things that I mentioned that oftentimes when you speak to men, they are as anxious to have the job site cleaned up as the women are. They don't necessarily want to come out. I mean, there's a small percentage, you know, who want it there and like it. But there's a greater percentage that feels like, you know, this doesn't need to be here at work. Some of the job conditions, you know, not having bathrooms, clean bathrooms, things like that, that, you know, traditionally when women come onto the job, now they're recognized, but the benefits really affect the men as much as they affect the women. And they welcome those changes, but oftentimes they're just, you know, uneasy or afraid to be the ones to say, go about and let's, you know, let's make these changes. The unions have to look at the, you know, work environment. You know, is it a hostile work environment? And oftentimes, you know, that's what happens when you start ignoring any individual's rights. But as I said, what I find is that when you protect the rights and respect one group, then really all groups can benefit from it. In my union, we had I did a survey of the women in my union to find out if they had experienced harassment in the union, and what was their work experience. I had to get it okay before I was able to get the list and send it out. And, you know, I was not so happy to find out that all the questions that had to do specifically with sexual harassment were removed from the survey. So We were able to give other information to them on general work questions, but the concern was that if those questions came back and it was negative, it could be a problem for the union. So, I mean, there's still areas where we, you know, we need improvement. The challenge is really taking small steps. The bottom line, when it comes to building trade unions and embracing diversity, is this: our skilled labor force is dwindling. With retirement, you know, death, a number of reasons. And there's no way that we can keep up as a strong trade union in New York City if we're not active in recruiting. Well, we have to recruit everywhere. Anywhere there's a person who has the skill that we need or who has the desire to learn that skill, we have to accept them. Accepting them also means that we are going to have to accept a cultural change that may come in to our union. And we might have to change. That's the bottom line. There was as I mentioned, the executive order was 6.9% workforce participation for women on federal construction sites. Now there's only about 2.5%. So there's quite a bit of change that must go. If unions are going to be successful, then they're going to have to not only actively recruit people that are different from what they're accustomed to recruiting, but also come up with ways to try and retain these workers. Diversity training is an absolute must. A good diversity training. Poor diversity training is worse than having none at all. And I've seen the poor diversity training go on. That was the one I did before I went to training at Cornell. And it was a circus. Really, professional type diversity training is definitely a must. And after the unions, they put in place goals, because sometimes the way you're treated just based on there's not enough of you there. So they put on goals as to a certain amount of participation they want into the unions. Then they have to make an environment that's really conducive for workers. Across the board, a union worker, we pride ourselves in a fair day's work, a fair day's pay, and good working conditions. But many of the building trade unions have gotten away from this because money management a lot of times, you know, starts to dictate what the work conditions should be. So that's important for us to be able to have union solidarity, to move to have good working conditions for everyone. So the challenge I found out for us is going to be for us to change with the world around us. The unions are changing, the interests are changing, we have to change also. There was a quote from John F. Kennedy. He said, "The world is changing. The old ways will not do. It's time for a new generation of leadership." And that's what it boils down to. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Next, I'd like to introduce Eduardo Rosario. And he's going to give his presentation as well.
A few people that came in after. We have some copies of my abstract. I just wanted to give up. If you don't mind, I'm going to sit down and do my report.
He's tired now.
He's tired. I too, like my sisters before me, wrote about a topic that was near and dear to my heart. I have worked most of my career in the printing trades, and printing is part of the manufacturing base of our economy. And as we all know, printing has taken a shellacking. And our manufacturing base has dwindled considerably. And I wanted to investigate, particularly with the sector work that I come from, why was that? What exactly happened? And as I did my investigation and my research, I found out, unlike the automotive industry and airline industry, there's quite a bit of history because printing, as you know, is one of our rights. And it all roads cross at where the manufacturing clause of the Copyright Act of the United States is. And that's where I'd like to start with. And I'd like to begin with a question that when we're done, we can hopefully delve into some of these questions. And I'd like to begin with these. Why do today's conditions in print manufacturing in the United States pale in comparison to what they once were? What has been the balance sheet since the manufacturing clause has been dismantled in 1986? And what lessons the trade union movement and the working class has learned since? We cannot properly take on the full breadth and scope of all the questions and salient points associated with the question of the manufacturing clause if we do not place this discussion in historical as well as in a national and international context. In my thesis, I covered the origins of the relationship between a publisher, printer, journeyperson, and apprentice. Originally, they were all one and the same person working out of one's home. But with technological advances, automation paved the way for the separation between the artisan and the publisher. Hence, the first seed sown for a contentious battle that will continue for well over 100 years. Also, that I had taken up was the Brentwood Conference, which essentially established the World Trade, the World, not the World, the GATT, International Monetary Fund, and the World Bank. I also took up issues of the legislative battles that went on just as long as the battles between publisher and worker. But there isn't time for us to delve into all these deeply into these areas, but key points I feel are of importance to touch upon and relevant for today's discussion when placed in context of the struggles of workers as a class and the organizations who represent the interests of workers as a class, namely the trade unions. Why do today's conditions in print manufacturing in the United States pale in comparison to what they once were? A good starting point is to begin with the effects of the dismantling of the manufacturing clause of the U.S. Copyright Act has had on the printing industry. Such historical data offers the potential for a much fuller understanding, while in turn begins to establish how such effects and impositions upon the printing industry can be viewed in context with today's global economy. To know the past is to better understand the present condition, creating opportunity to effectuate in a positive, proactive manner the future as trade unionists and as communities of conscience. Just as industries such as automotive, aviation, textile and steel, the printing industry's experience with the global forces that have come with the terrain of the free market economy has been no exception. It is in this context I wish to share how the over 100-year battle for dismantling the manufacturing clause was one of many battles that set the stage for the draconian policies of globalization, such as deregulation and outsourcing. Such policies have disproportionately affected workers of the printing trades and industries. Equally important is to evaluate how small to medium-sized manufacturing companies all across the United States have fared in the post-manufacturing clause era. According to the Department of Labor report, Termination of the Manufacturing Clause, an analysis of potential employment effects, but the manufacturing clause of the U.S. copyright law, which in various forms has been in effect since 1891, provide a measure of protection from foreign competition for domestic producers of certain types of printed materials. It went on to state, the clause prohibits imports of copies of works preponderantly of non-dramatic literary materials in the English language authored by U.S. citizens or domiciliaries and of U.S. copyrighted material unless manufactured in the United States or Canada. This set the precedent for establishing a manufacturing clause to prevent a flight of print manufacturing jobs out of the United States. having federal regulations stipulating what was published in the U.S., also having to be printed in the U.S., for some was a boon, for others was regarded with much contempt. The major players in this fight were the workers of the printing and graphic communications industry, along with print manufacturers. They wanted the manufacturing clause to become a permanent federal regulation in the U.S. Those who no longer wanted the existence of a manufacturing clause were the U.S. Copyright Department, as well as publishers and author associations. Also interested in seeing the manufacturing clause dismantled were international interests who obviously were seeking a way to gain access to the U.S. market. The effects of global forces upon the U.S. printing industry have not been researched or documented as extensively when compared to other sectors of the manufacturing base of the U.S. economy. As far as its scale of economy, the printing industry has never been as large in comparison, for example, to the automobile industry or airline industry. The printing industry was, however, the fourth largest employer in the manufacturing sector of the U.S. economy at one time. A look at the magnitude of the employment decline in two-digit manufacturing industries from 1979 to 1982 reveals the only major industry groups to post gains were printing and instruments. That's remember the time when instruments like Texas Instrument Calculator were all walking around with them. Those sectors of the manufacturing base of our economy were the only sectors that were actually growing and succeeding and making a profit. It was great employment opportunities for many workers that sought employment in those sectors of the economy. Here's the critical error on the part of the proponents for dismantling the manufacturing clause of the U.S. Copyright Act, believing the printing industry would remain immune to these same economic pressures and instabilities which other manufacturing industries of the U.S. economy were suffering at that time. It was precisely because of the manufacturing clause print manufacturing was shielded from the instabilities of the free market economy. The U.S. Copyright Act is one of the oldest existing pieces of legislation. The first copyright law of the United States of America was enacted during the second session of the first Congress on May 31st, 1790, and signed by President George Washington. The spirit of the U.S. Copyright Act back in 1790 was to establish legislatively a protection and provision that was set up for the encouragement of learning by securing the copies of maps, charts, and books to authors and proprietors of such copies for a period of 14 years. One could petition the federal government for an extension as long as it was done 6 months prior to the expiration of the first term of the aforesaid 14 years. Mind you, this was a time period that most of what people read at that time in the United States came from England. What the first copyright law of the United States did not do was grant equal protections and rights for works from authors and proprietors from foreign nations as it had done for those authors and proprietors from the U.S. It was not until March 3, 1891, when the International Copyright Act, also known as the Chase Act, had passed, did the United States finally grant foreign authors equal treatment if the author's country of citizenship granted reciprocal protections to the work of authors of the U.S. Authors were resentful with the restrictions the manufacturing clause represented. Such was the case with many American authors. The Chase Act restricted the import of foreign printed books by denying U.S. copyright protection to, at first, works by English language authors and then to American authors unless their work was printed in the United States. It was through this provision, for example, the works of Henry Miller, including the Tropic of Cancer and Tropic of Capricorn, were kept out of the United States because only a French printer could be found to publish them. This restriction on granting copyright to the works by American authors printed abroad was not removed by 1984. I want to touch base on that one point because I did a lot of research specifically For me, it was kind of sad that the authors took the position that they did and they sided with the publishers, because I saw the authors as workers just as the man and woman in the print shop are working in the bindery. But for the life of me, I could never find a reason why it wasn't a meeting of the mind, where there was never an agreement that could be found in the publisher. I feel that all workers need to have the right to have their jobs and their working conditions protected. But I just thought that part was kind of unfortunate, because I thought it could have been something that could have been broken between authors and the workers and the print manufacturers. I just want to just throw that in. International interests were at play for over 100 years, engaged in efforts to amend or abolish the manufacturing clause. The beginning of this international struggle began in 1883 with the Berne Convention, 2 years after the passing of the International Copyright Act of 1881. The Berne Convention was centered upon basic principles that contained a series of provisions determining the minimum protection to be granted, as well as special provisions available to developing nations who can reserve the right to invoke the provisions of the Berne Convention. In marked leadership and patent conventions, the United States declined an invitation to a pivotal conference in Bern, Switzerland in 1883, and did not sign the 1886 agreement of the Berne Convention that accorded national treatment to copyright holders. It was not until 1891 when the balance of trade in literary and artistic works was swinging in its favor that the United States reformed its copyright laws. Even then, concessions to printers' unions, such as the requirements that copyrighted books had to be printed in the United States or typeset with U.S. plates, contributed to U.S. failure to comply with the terms of the Berne Convention until 1988. This clearly demonstrates how the U.S. government's self-interest at that time was clearly vested in protecting the interests of the printer and print manufacturer. The relationship between the U.S. government and workers of the printing industry over time would change as global interest became a greater factor in deciding the economic policies of the United States. The United States, a young country establishing itself in the global market, was geared towards developing not just print manufacturing, but manufacturing overall. By closing its doors, it shielded U.S. manufacturing from international markets and interests seeking to infiltrate the U.S. economy. By the same token, the U.S. was establishing itself internationally by exporting its goods abroad cheaply. This was a time period Americans were not consuming many retail products because of the residual effects from the economic depression that began in 1872. To compensate for its overproduction of goods, U.S. monopolies of the Industrial Revolution began to export products that were not being consumed at home. It is for these reasons many trade unions pressured Congress for establishing protections that would maintain and expand on job creation within the United States during this period of economic hardship. At one time, because of the strength of the U.S. economy, the ability to outsource work from the United States to other countries, particularly in the manufacturing sector of the U.S. economy, seldom ever occurred. Fast forward 100 years later, the genesis of the free market economy and the tools for implementing the agenda of globalization, such as deregulation and privatization, this previously had been a phenomenon relegated to countries outside the United States until approximately the 1960s. In 2010, conditions are far worse economically, not just for those workers of the printing industry, but also for the economy as a whole, regardless of what sector one works. I began today's discussion with the question, why do today's conditions in print manufacturing in the United States pale in comparison to what they once were? I feel it's safe to say that indeed, dismantling the manufacturing clause of the U.S. Copyright Act did contribute to the loss of printing jobs and reduce the power of the printing sector within U.S. manufacturing. In 1986, President of the Graphic Communications International Union, GCIU, James Norton, stated to the Senate Judiciary Committee, The worsening trade situation clearly indicates that 1986 is the worst time to allow the manufacturing clause to expire, because the dollar is extremely overvalued, the wage differential between the United States and its low-wage foreign competitors is exceedingly high. This differential gives imports a clear advantage. Despite greater transport costs, the overvalued dollar often allows low-wage Pacific Basin and Caribbean Basin nations to deliver manufactured products at a lower price than our domestic counterparts. James Norton went on to state, the U.S. printer, which presently have overseas operations, could expand their overseas plants to print for the American market. Additionally, U.S. printing companies could build overseas plants to take advantage of the wage differential. These plants may be able to move offshore, but U.S. workers will not move with them. Once again, we would be exporting American jobs and increasing our trade deficit through the importation of more printed materials. Once these jobs are gone, we can never expect them to come back. What is also called into question is whose interests are being served. Clearly, by dismantling the manufacturing clause, it has hurt more than it has helped. Again, we must reflect on how can this be prevented from happening in the future. When laws and regulations of a nation are subordinated to the dictates of profit and monopoly, clearly, what is being called into question by such forces are the democratic rights of workers and communities. By the result of the latest economic crisis, clearly free trade has failed and has left too many people, not just in the United States, but also across the globe, worse off than before. The theory of free trade and the assuredness of prosperity globalization was to bring has fallen short of its promise. Deregulation and privatization are the tools that have been used to implement the free trade agenda globally. Such tools of austerity attack the very rights of workers to be allowed to have a job and undermine all social safety nets by exacerbating such limited resources with the growing number of unemployed. GATT, eventually to become the World Trade Organization, were set up with a mission to establish international norms and conditions in order to gain greater control of the natural resources and capital of nations. Doing so without restriction or regard for the law of the land. When such international norms and conditions are in conflict with the regulations and laws of the nations, it is the regulations and laws of nations that are deemed as trade barriers and must be overturned. And in this instance, it was the manufacturing clause that had to be dismantled. This is a dangerous proposition, for the gains and rights of workers and peoples as a whole are codified in context of the nation. It is imperative to defend labor rights, environmental protections, and civil liberties, and help prepare and educate all future generations to the consequences if they are not. The dismantling of the manufacturing clause is just one of many instances where rights of workers and nations have been attacked, all in the name of employers gaining greater flexibility to maximize profits at the expense of workers and communities. A dispute arises when a member nation of the WTO believes another member nation is violating an agreement or commitment that it has made with the WTO. The authors of these agreements are the member governments themselves. The agreements are the outcome of negotiations among members. Ultimate responsibility for settling disputes also lies with member governments through the dispute settlement body of the WTO. We do not get the vote for these representatives of the WTO, but resisting the WTO and its policies of deregulation and privatization is the mandate of all trade unionists, as well as the international trade union movement. According to the WTO, there's a system of conflict resolution nations can go to and present their case in hope of resolving disputes between nations. The WTO goes on to state their procedure for resolving trade quarrels under the dispute settlement understanding is vital for enforcing its rules and therefore ensuring that trade flows smoothly. This here is the only law global capital understands. and it is to ensure trade flows smoothly. The manufacturing clause was a trade barrier and went against trade from flowing smoothly for those who sought to take advantage of the exploitative working conditions of developing and underdeveloped nations. In the words of Jack Henning, Secretary Treasurer Emeritus of the California Labor Federation of the AFL-CIO, told delegates of the November 14th through 16th Western Hemisphere Conference Against NAFTA and Privatizations in San Francisco, the answer to global capitalism is global unionism, and labor has to be at the heart of the resistance. It is the proposition of building global unionism multinational corporations fear the most, but it is precisely the response the international labor movement must forge in solidarity to ensure its viability as a movement into the future. In doing so, labor preserves the right and privilege to continue to fight for the interests of workers everywhere. Thank you.
We welcome questions. If you have any questions, for the three of us.
So, Eduardo, what do you do in printing shirts?
What do you mean?
What's your job?
It's interesting because I wrote this thesis and I graduated last year. It was on the 26th, 27th. I graduated in June, and by July 1st, I was laid off on the very topic that I wrote about. Right now, I was working for the Amalgamated Developers, Local 1, and I was a business agent organizer. But throughout my career, I started off in the trades in 1985 as a truck driver, making pickups and deliveries, and I just put my best foot forward, and they liked my work and started teaching me the trade. I worked in the press room. I was a journeyman pressman. I worked in pre-press production, doing graphic artwork, and as a journey person as well. So I've worked in various sectors within the graphic communications field. And within the union itself, I worked serving a membership from everywhere, from a shop steward to being the president of a local union.
The only reason I ask is that prior to the 1986 deregulation, union busting in the printing trades had already underway. In 1977, in Madison, Wisconsin, you had two newspapers that were morning paper and afternoon paper that were all unionized. Mm-hmm. And when they shifted from hot type to cold type, that's the opening that the newspapers took to get rid of their unions, because that affected the ITU a lot. Yeah. Because everything is done in front of a computer and you're not working on a lot of paper. And so the two newspapers succeeded in busting the newspaper to go to the ITU and the others and the printers. And that, so this is during the Carter administration. And so, I mean, that kind of, because the Newspaper Preservation Act was designed to keep two papers in the community, which that's long gone. And if you had one paper, you're lucky. And so many newspaper jobs were lost.
Yeah. When I was in San Francisco, where I lived at the time, that's where I really cut my teeth in the labor movement. The two dailies were the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Examiner. The Examiner, the publisher for the Examiner, was the Hearst Corporation. And the Hearst family were the key lobbyists and author of much of the language of the Newspaper Preservation Act that established, I believe, back in 65, 66, the joint operating agreements that had existed in many metropolitan regions. When that transfer from hot type, that's where a stereotype worked, I'm now talking like jargon from printing, there was a lot of work that was lost. In commercial printing, automation really hit the commercial sector of the printing trades in starting like around 84, 85, where you used to have a bank of 10 people working light cables, stripping up film. Now it was reduced down to two people on a computer.
Right.
Local One had witnessed, that was its first big hit back in 86 when that happened.
And my brother-in-law is a stripper, and so when people ask him what his job is, he's a stripper.
Yeah, I was a stripper. I was a stripper. That's a term, a trade term, but it means that you're stripping film. That is stripper stripping.
My question was, have you ever, in the diversity trainings, do you ever talk about things like white supremacy? Can you go there? Or is that too far for people? What do you think?
I've never talked about it. Well, I shouldn't say I haven't talked about it. And briefly, there is one example that I mentioned of a mechanic, an apprentice who was working with a mechanic, and they worked very well together. The mechanic is white, the apprentice was black. And they had no problems, he was teaching him. And as they got hotter, he started to take off his stuff, and he ended up with a sleeveless shirt and had a swashing orange. And so the black mechanic, the apprentice, he said, what's that about? And his response was, you know what it's about, and continue to work. So I really use that as an example of we're not really trying to change your individual makeup, if you believe that because you're white, you're supreme, or a person who believes that, black power, black is the, top race or whatever, I really try to focus on, it's an ideal world if we could all get rid of all our prejudice, all our racist ideas and everything. What we're concerned about is the work environment. And he was a good example of someone who had some very strong beliefs, but he didn't bring it into the workplace. He didn't hang out with them, had drinks with them after work. And he was respectful and how he dealt with them at work. And he taught them to train. So the other guy was a little taken back about it, but the bottom line is that he was fair to them at work and he trained them properly. So I bring it up really in that sense is that your personal views are your personal views. But now we're talking about building solidarity and what's legal and what's not legal in the workforce, and that's a different issue. And respect and diversity comes from both ends. I mean, also on the end when you don't agree with the person's beliefs. So I look at it really from that perspective. Everyone's entitled.
Talk about history, I think that the country sort of founded on slavery and racism, and I think that kind of persists in our consciousness, whether you realize it or not. Do you ever talk about that kind of history?
Yes. Yes, definitely. I mean, it's part of American culture, so I don't ignore parts of our culture that we might not be proud of or that's uncomfortable. It's part of our culture. It's how we think. And if we're going to try to go away from it, we really have to kind of jump out of our box to think differently. If I'm walking down the street and I see, five or six young white men in jeans and a shirt and all with bald heads, I'm going to really think twice about that. I'm going to stay on the side of the street or across the street. So can I fault someone who sees, five young men with their pants baggy and, caps on backwards, they do the same thing. Unfortunately, we're all a part of our environment. And, it's helpful those classes in terms of really thinking out of the box. Again, this is our culture. This is our history. What needs to be changed? How much of this do you want part of you? And does any of it fit within the workplace? And I really try to focus on the workplace. I tell them all in terms of stenography, nobody's bothered about your pictures. They're welcome at home. Put them on the refrigerator. I'm not sure your wife won't mind. Slap them up there. It's your pictures. But it's just not appropriate for the workplace. So that's really more so looking at what's appropriate and not appropriate for the workplace rather than trying to change who they are. And particularly, I think this is close to my group, you know, I'm dealing with, you know, 90% construction males, and they have a certain culture stereotype that they're kind of proud of. So I can't get too fuzzy with them, otherwise I lose them all, you know. So we gotta, I don't know, be yourself, but, you know, be respectful in the job place. Whoever you are after work is fine, but when you're at work, your behavior is belongs to someone else. You're being paid for a behavior, a certain type of behavior that leads you improper or the United States government, you know, being improper.
I have a question. I was just wondering, when you talked about the example of the swastika and on, I was just wondering about the types of responses that you've gotten, and because I suppose my first reaction was that I feel very uncomfortable, you know, and I think I think that's something that we bring who we are into the workplace, right, as people and all that we are, our commitments or beliefs that the world has set. So yes.
I think too, part of that was that it was covered. He kept it covered really the whole time. On this particular day, it got so hot, you know, that he had a different shirt on. So, you know, sometimes with our industry, I mean, everyone has all types of tattoos of all sorts. Is it illegal to have that on your arm? Well, it's not really illegal to have it on your arm. Smart, probably not too smart, not more politically correct, but in itself, he broke the laws by having it on his arm. He certainly wasn't being abusive at any rate to the person he worked with. So it was an uncomfortable situation, but he wasn't putting it in his face, and he was teaching him and teaching the trade and dealing with him as a respectful, respectful individual. So in that case, you know, the other person had to kind of suck it up and just, you know, get over it, you know, realize, you know, everyone doesn't think about that. And part of diversity, everyone's entitled to their personal beliefs, as long as those beliefs are not stomping on another person. And in that case, if there wasn't, but it's not an easy situation.
Okay, this is a question for all three of you. There's a book called The Imposter. I can't remember the author's name now. But one of the things that was mentioned in the book is about the, I'm paraphrasing this, not exactly right, but the conflict, the possible internal conflict of being working class and going on to get your degree. And the feeling of perhaps uncomfortability sometimes with family, because I think the example that I heard was that, you know, a flower isn't supposed to rise above, it's supposed to stay at the same level. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if any of you experienced that. Mm-hmm. And if you could talk about that.
Well, I'm going to jump into that one. My local recently had a union election, and I supported the dissident. And when I did that, the incumbent went after me with line and sinker. And when I put a piece in our local chief, that's the labor paper, that I felt Local 237 should be giving an education benefit and be more proactive with health and safety, because housing authority works in terrible, terrible working conditions. The caretakers are using terrible chemicals. We're breathing in the stuff from 9/11. So I wrote that piece, and they had, Local 237 had their health and safety person, who is not a union member, who won a grant to work at 237, call the National Labor College, because in that piece I used my title as adjunct instructor and Cornell counselor, and they tried to get me fired. They said that Laney is too educated and is going after us, and, you know, who the hell does she think she is? They called Cornell several times to try to get me fired. And so in my particular local, they hate when you go to school. I was a self-payer for the Cornell Labor Studies Certificate and Advanced Certificate Program, and I also was a self-payer at the National Labor College. And so that's why it's very important to me to try to get an education benefit. They refuse. They refuse because they feel they use their education money to train us. I'm with housing 24 years. I've never been trained in anything. I don't know where the money's going. And when I went to the newly elected incumbent president, I said, Greg, you know, I'd like to go to Cornell's Union Leadership School. He goes, oh, Lane, you're well beyond that. So I said, well, if I'm well beyond that, maybe I should run for president of the school. So they frown on education. They frown on education. They really frown on education in my particular local. They also tried to get me out of, I'm president of my particular group, the housing system chapter, and my term was up. They ran two people against me, two, and I still won chapter president. Because the membership knows when you work for them. They know. And they hate that I keep trying to educate my membership. So, as far as that's concerned, yes, this flower had a lot of leaves falling off this year. But I won, you know, and that's wonderful to feel, you know, the pride of having an education, having a way and a route to go that I know is important to me and my members. So I did experience that.
I definitely experienced it on the job. A big reason why I went back to school is because I started writing on the wall. Years before I got laid off, that this is going to come to an abrupt end, and I don't know when, but I have to be prepared. You know, I have little children, I have a family, and I got to think about taking care of them. And one of the first things I thought, well, you got to finish college. When certain people in the job, on the job, found that I was going back to school, I went to Cornell University. Immediately, you know, it was like, what are you doing that for? You held a suspect. What are you looking to run for my job? And it's like, I just never even dignified anything that their comments, because these people need a life. Maybe they should be going to school themselves. But yeah, I did experience some of that. It was unfortunate. Forward, I knew what I had to do, and plus, I really, when I went back to school, I found out how much I loved it. It wasn't like when I was younger going to college. I thought to myself, I wish I had the enthusiasm and the discipline that I had now, like I did back then when I first went to college right out of high school. Because I like all of it.
I think that goes for all three of us. We went back to school later on in life because, as Ed said, life gets in your way, you have a family, you have a job, you don't have time to go to school, which is the beauty of the National Labor College. It's really geared to working adults, where, you know, you go there and it's an experience like I've never had in my life. And it has now afforded me another career. I'm teaching for them. I'm an adjunct teaching prior learning assessment for people in the labor movement who can write up to 30 credits of life experience, which is a gift. It's really a gift. And, you know, with union density really falling right now, it is imperative that you bring this message back, that people have to go back to school, get the degrees, and become really, really educated union members, because that's our power now. This up here.
Don't stop with the bachelor's.
No, keep going.
Believe you want to.
My family is very supportive, and I think the advantage that I had is that as I was going back, I was teaching. So as a teacher within my union, I was teaching the apprentices. They expected me to be involved in education, and I always pushed my students. So I almost had to go back just to set them by the example for them. You know, I had to make time. And even when I don't teach for my union now, but I still teach for the international. I'm not met with too much. flexibility. Maybe some of the management within the union, they worry about me a little, but that was before I even went back to school because I, you know, I tend to speak up for something that I don't think is correct. So, but in terms of balancing, you know, your union work and your worker and how who you've been to, that kind of thing, no, I didn't know. I never experienced that.
Is there currently any effort or legislation to address the manufacturing cost?
None whatsoever.
So this is not, well, nothing's dead in terms of legislation and policy.
Yeah, I understand.
Maybe neoliberalism is dying in this economic crisis, and globalization is facing the crisis. And I think it's a period in which policies that are beneficial to workers can be revived. I mean, it's part of the political discussion about how to get out of this crisis. But this is maybe, so this is like a requiem, not really an advocacy.
Yeah, I personally am not aware of any kind of activity, legislatively speaking, regarding any kind of international trade protections for any sector of the manufacturing base of our economy that's been taken up in any committee. I'm not saying that it's not happening, but I'm just not aware that there is one. If there was one, I'm sure the AFL-CIO would have had it up on their website. Along with other unions on their international meetings website. I'm not saying that it's not, but I'm just not aware of it. Sorry, I didn't answer your question.
So there is the Border Equity Tax Act, which has been introduced in Congress, to equalize the tax treatment at the border between countries that impose a value-added tax, such as 70% of our trading partners and the United States, which has direct taxes. And that's meant to slow the flow of industrial out of the country. That's the only one I know of.
Thank you.
Given
Lincoln,
I
just
want to go over time, but I just wanted to the diversity point. I think it was really fascinating. The view that you presented is like it's so realistic of the, and I suppose it's because you had experience doing diversity, right? Change. Because a lot of times when we talk about diversity, we do expect people to sort of embrace the diversity with, you know, knowing just forget all your prejudices, they will be gone if you, you know, click your heels 3 times. But, so is there, I didn't find the swastika example, but then isn't there like a danger to saying that all of that stuff should just stay out of the workplace, all of your sort of personal prejudices and so forth, that is about respectfully the workplace? Doesn't it make it difficult to build like active solidarity instead of just, you know, don't discriminate, be fair to everybody? But if it's going to be a strong union movement, then people have to actually actively support one another, right? Mm-hmm. So is there like a story or a narrative of union power, union solidarity that could appeal to a diverse group of people?
Mm-hmm. Well, to me, our union solidarity comes from what's our future? We do want our future to be. Everyone is quite aware that unions are losing their power. As a union worker, we see every day the work that we lose to not union, and we see the political climate that's against unions. So that's what we're dealing with. That's
right.
That's the facts.
Right.
Now, are we going to come together and try to fight this? This is our biggest fault. We're not really each other's fault. Look at all we have in common. First of all, I mean, we have the trade in common. Most of us have a love for the trade, a desire to pass it on to someone else. We have people in our family that we love and support. We have similar humor, senses of humor after, you know, being in the trade. And so we have a lot of things really that are in common, and we really try to focus on those things. The things that are different about us, some things you can accept, some things you don't accept. But the, are they interfering with the work environment? Really, I mean, what your lifestyle after work is really doesn't stop you from being solidified with people on this front. So, if you, I mean, looking to what they're outside in the work environment, really, there's very few I hang with. So, but in the work environment, there's a lot of decent people there that I'm glad to work with. So, it's too bored, really, when you start looking at their individual, you know, preferences. It's just really just too broad, and we're at a point we have to really focus to recruit, train, and retain our workers so that we can build a strong force. And one thing I try to remember, it also remind them of, in our union, I'll say, how many are here are, you know, of their families of five generations and, you know, Americans? Very, very few can raise their hand. You can. I can too, but there's very, very few. The vast majority don't go past three. So who do we? We're all, you know, the vast majority is immigrants. I only can raise my hand because I can go back and then it's slavery and we lose it.
Right.
But when you look at it from that perspective, okay, we're all immigrants. Okay, what happened to your group when they came here? What happened to your group? So this is another group. You know, are we always going to pick the new group to hate? Or are we going to, you know, start being smart and kind of look at it from an economic perspective?
Right, I think employers have certainly historically used that quite deliberately.
I don't know if you're going to go further with your research on this, but I think it'd be worth looking at the way, well, I mean, first of all, in this current social climate, race is seen as color, but certainly in the early days of those building trades, you can be white, but it would depend on what part of Europe you came
from.
So I think that to say that those unions were just built forward by white men who just, like, you know, did what they had to do, ignores the fact that there was yes, discrimination, and there was the same kind of internal struggles. Whose face is painted on the other? Is something that's worthy of study as well. And I don't know, there might be something out there that anybody knows about, let me know.
Well, if you look at old political cartoons from the 19th century, late 19th century, if they showed an Irish worker, they always had this kind of like simian face. Mm-hmm. They had real tiny nose, a big upper lip, and they made him look apish. And you can go back and you can find all these old racist stereotypes of the day old. All these things, and so, and again, you probably find out that it was to the boss's advantage to have each of these immigrant groups fighting amongst themselves instead of fighting up the rural workers. But even if you were so-called white, still, if you were Eastern European, you were stupid. If you were Western European, you were smart. You know, the Germans thought the Czechs were Indians and the Poles were stupid, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And so it was really, that's an interesting point, because it, I bought an old clip art book of it was called Vintage Cartoons, and it was full of these old anti-Irish stereotypes. And I read it, and I thought, do you realize what you're doing is when you put these old cartoons into this clip art book? That these were actually racist stereotypes that were used. If you look at even the liberal magazines like Puck and Judge in the 1880s and 1890s, they used that the racial stereotype. Jewish cartoons, anti-Irish cartoons, the anti-Black cartoons that were in the popular illustrated magazines of the day. I mean, ethnic humor was like a big deal. I just loved it. Mm-hmm. And it was a favorite cartoon of mine that I found in an old issue of Judge. And it shows this long string of people coming up to the ballot box, and Uncle Sam is sitting in front of the ballot box. And each of the people has an American like suit and then their native costume. And he says, well, you're all half American, so you should only get half a vote. And you have the Italian, you have the Irish, you have the Greek, you have, you know, every ethnic group that was coming into the United States during that period of immigration. But, you know, that kind of stereotype didn't really matter what your color was, because
Thanks, everybody, for coming in.